Hi there, everybody. My name is Bea Bonner, and you're listening to Community Voices right here on NPR Illinois. Today, I am talking to award-winning broadcaster Alvin Hall and social activist Janae Woods Weber from the podcast Driving the Green Book, and Jamie Stout, board member of the African American History Museum. Welcome, everybody.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Now, starting off, how about you all tell us a little bit about yourselves, where you're from, and how you sort of get into this business? Let's start with Janae, and then we'll go to Alvin, and then we'll go to Jamie.
Thank you. My name is Janae Woods Weber. I live in Connecticut. For the past couple of decades, I have really focused my work on the liberation of people who are oppressed, in particular, Black folks. I have worked for several years training community organizers around the country on how to bring their communities together to engage in dialogue and to work toward action. I also have been active in many popular social movements like the Black Lives Matter movement, the Abolish ICE movement. You can regularly find me at protests in my community. I'm currently working in a family foundation that focuses on equity and education, which means we take a very hard look at the ways in which racism and poverty impact educational outcomes for students. I got into this work, the podcasting business, through my relationship with Alvin. I've been fortunate to know Alvin. It's been a minute. I realized yesterday I met Alvin when I was about 22 years old, and now I'm 44. So I have had Alvin with me for half of my life, and it has been just a wonderfully exciting experience and also a great blessing. And Alvin and I share a lot of interests in history, especially Black history. We share a lot of interests in food and culture and music. So when he invited me to embark on this journey, this road trip with him to discover the Green Book, of course I had to say yes.
I'm Alvin Hall, and I do broadcasts and teach about the financial markets. I do programs about how to manage money well, and I write books. I've been doing this a long time. I started my broadcast career when literally I was discovered in the Photographer's Gallery in Leicester Square in London. And I met a man there who said, you should be on television. And that led to my career on the BBC. There I hosted a landmark program called Your Money or Your Life, which was the first program that was about how people should handle their finances responsibly. It was a reality show that ran for 5 incredible years, and we had Christmas specials and everything. The way I got involved in the Green Book really came out of my work for BBC Radio 4. After I left television, I did a program for the BBC called Jay-Z from Brooklyn to the Boardroom that looked at Jay-Z's evolution from a musical star to a strong and forceful and visionary business person. And that won several awards for me. After that, I have a lot of relationships at the BBC. And I was reading about the Green Book in a magazine, and it happened that another producer was reading about it in a magazine, and he called me up and said, would you like to host the show? And I said, yes. And first I did a BBC program about the Green Book, but that wasn't very satisfying. It was only 37 minutes, and there was so much more to be discovered. And I came up with the idea for the podcast, and I was looking around for who would have the emotional intelligence, the thoughtfulness, the contemporary language, who could bring a new multi-generational perspective to the program. And one name kept coming up in my mind again and again, my friend Janae Woods Weber. And so we started this trip together.
And I'm Jamie Stout. I serve as a volunteer board member for the Springfield and Central Illinois African American History Museum. My full-time job, I work for the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation as the Director of Membership and Annual Giving. I discovered Janae and Alvin's podcast. I'm an avid podcast listener of all genres and all topics. And this was one that was recommended from another podcast. I immediately listened, and I I binge listened. I went back and listened to every single one of them, and I kept talking about it, and I was telling friends. And then we at the museum started to do webinars to continue to educate and engage our members and our community in telling the stories of African Americans. And I was like, on a whim, I'm going to reach out and see if they can tell their story to our community. And so that's how it got started.
When I was listening to the podcast last week, I was just immediately like, oh my gosh, this is so good. So, you know, I'm so glad that you all are gonna, you know, be in Springfield. We'll not actually be here because, you know, everything's by Zoom now. But I'm so glad that the Springfield community is going to be able to experience this, because I think it's important. And, you know, one thing I would like for you all to do is maybe give a little history about the Green Book. You know, I don't think a lot of people may know about it. I know a lot of times when I was doing my research, the one thing that came up was the 2018 film, The Green Book. And so that's where a lot of people are getting their experience and their research from. So would you mind giving us a little bit of history for, you know, those that may not know?
The Green Book was started by Victor Hugo Green and his wife, Alma. They lived in Harlem, specifically Sugar Hill. And Alma had relatives in Richmond, Virginia. So they would take annual trips down to visit her relatives. And while they were on those trips, they were often unable to buy gasoline. They certainly could not stop and use a restroom. They could not buy food. So they had to pack everything on the car. And these repeated trips caused Victor to think about the frustrations that not only he and Alma experienced on the road, but other people who are part of their friends who traveled to New England. So in 1936, he started focusing on the New York and the tri-state area, this book called The Negro Motorist Green Book. And it listed places where Black people could find safe harbor and services while traveling, whether it was hotels, restaurants, beauty salons, tailors, whatever you needed. In the early days, the listings consisted primarily of mechanics places that would repair cars and gasoline stations, because being broken down on the road was one of the worst things that could happen. Over the period of time, he expanded it across the US so that by 1938, it expanded to cover the entire 50 states. I think only two states were missing. There were many other publications out there like the Green Book, but the Green Book is the one that endured the most. And if you go and look at the Green Book, most people immediately go to their cities, in this case, Springfield, and you would see all the businesses that were listed during that period of time. In addition, the Green Book was sold at Exxon stores. In those days, they were known as Esso stores. It was the only gas station in America that allowed its franchisees to sell the Green Book in the stores. Others did not. This is one of the reasons you find that many older African Americans still to this day are quite devoted to Exxon stores, because they remember that history. And so gradually the book grew. I think at its height, it's estimated that it sold about 2 million copies a year, but there's no hard information about that in reality. Victor's dream was that at some point, there would be no need for this publication, and he thought the passing of the Civil Rights Act would indicate that. When that passed, gradually Victor saw very little need for it. He then died. His wife, Alma, kept the publication going for a number of years, then handed it off to two men who ran it. And then by 1967, that was the final edition of the Green Book.
And why do you think the history of the Green Book has not been taught in a lot of schools and places? You know, a lot of high schoolers and children, they don't get to hear about this. And so they're grown adults and some don't know at all.
This is because of a larger issue in that Black history is not taught in a comprehensive or meaningful way in our curriculum. Of course, Black history is American history, but it is often separated out. It's relegated to February, Black History Month. I know when I look back on my own education, you know, I was taught about Martin Luther King. He had a dream. Then we had the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and that was the extent of my education around African-American history. And it was not the true representation either of what actually transpired during that time. It was a very sanitized version. So When we think about what gets taught, of course, the Green Book would be left out, especially because what Alvin and I discovered on our trip was that even though the perilous times necessitated the Green Book also represented the ways in which African Americans lived whole, full lives. And of course, that's really never an element of our history that is shared. I think another reason why we don't know about this is because, like so many other elements of history, this is very personal for folks. I heard someone say, well, history really is yesterday, right? And for a lot of folks, this is still living memory. Jim Crow was not that long ago. Segregation was not that long ago. And it's painful to share these stories. It's painful to pass down these histories in ways in which they can be recorded and shared with the masses. And that was one of the reasons why we felt it was really important to capture these histories, these living memories, in the voices of the people who lived them and who experienced them. This is not sanitized or whitewashed. This is a celebration of their memories.
Speaking of whitewashing, let's talk about Hollywood's depiction of the Green Book or other historical African-American things that have happened in our community. Do you think that the depiction of the Green Book is accurate, or how could it be better if it's not accurate?
Well, there are three things about the movie that people should know. One, the title, The Green Book, was accidental. The producer, Peter Farrelly, saw this travel guide and thought, well, this may be what the driver used, and so let's just give it this name. So that was more accidental. The second thing is to remember that the book is told from the driver's point of view, not from Don Shirley's, the movie's point of view. So anything we see in the movie is through white eyes. As the scene, of course, that for me as a Southerner born in the same area of Don Shirley, as Don Shirley, is the fried chicken scene. You know, here's a man born in the panhandle of Florida, the same area I was, who went to Sunday school and church, and he does not know about fried chicken. That is not possible. So those types of things bothered me. And the third was, I went to a screening of the movie here in New York, and the moderator asked the actors, the producers, all the principals of the movie on stage, had they heard of the Green Book before they did the movie? The answer was no. So there was no one at the table to give them any guidance about what the real Green Book was like. So the movie is seen through white eyes. And I'm not sure how you can make that movie better unless you filmed it through Don Shirley's eyes. And then I think the story would be quite different.
The things that I found, that I discovered during our road trip that wasn't quite portrayed correctly in the movie was around just how fine the establishments were that were listed in the Green Book. In the movie, they're shown going to hotels that, you know, are not as beautiful or are less than savory. But what we learned was that the motels and the hotels, the restaurants that were listed in the Green Book were beautiful. I mean, we're talking rooms covered in gorgeous wallpaper, crystal chandeliers in restaurants, places where you had to dress to get in. It was an elevated social experience. That was not portrayed in the movie the way that it happened in real life.
Why is this so damaging, you think, to the African-American community and even to America in general?
Damaging, I think, because it brings sentimentality into the picture. I think the narrative arc of the story says that this Black man could not find himself without the help of this white man. That sort of white savior narrative is frequent in movies. And I think that's the real problem that most people have with this movie. Forget about the fact that Don Shirley is not portrayed as he probably was in real life, but it's just that white savior narrative and the sentimentality built around that. That scene, two scenes from that movie still stick with me. One is when the workers are in the house, I think repairing the refrigerator or doing something with the plumbing, and they drink water out of the glass and the people throw the glasses in the trash can. That was so common during that period of time. In Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns, she talked about how many of the people from the army would come into Penn Station and go into a bar and have a beer, and then they would break the glasses into the trash can after that. And then you have the scene where he comes to the house at the very end of the movie, and they, you know, are more open to him, but yet they had been talking about him and calling him a baboon early in the movie. The transition occurred that quickly? Miracles of miracles? I don't think so.
Stay tuned to hear the rest of the interview.